Professing Baptist Podcast, a podcast by Reformed Baptists for Reformed Baptists. Get more headlines at confessingbaptist.com. And now on to today's episode.
All right, everybody, this is Junior, and this is the Confessing Baptist Podcast. Today is Tuesday, May something or other, and we're going to interview one of my favorite people, Dr. James Renahan, over there at the Institute for Reformed Baptist Studies. And this is something I love to do. I became a Christian when I was 29 years old, and right away, after about 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years, I found out about Baptist history, just because before that, I thought, you know, Christianity started with Chuck Smith, you know, and then I found out, and then I found out about church history,
the Moses model.
I love, you know, church history, and you know, Nick Needham, Tom Nettles, Michael Haken, and of course Dr. Jim Renahan. So check out this interview, and then we ask you guys a question. When we're done with the interview, I want you to get your opinion on a question I asked of him, and see if you guys thought it was weird.
What's the interview on?
Oh, yeah. So the interview is going to be, you know, it's about Baptist origins, right? Different theories of Baptist origins, both in Britain and here in the colonies. Well, the it was then in the colonies. Yeah, now it's the U.S., but yeah. So and it's about an hour long, I think, Jason, or so. And
we're 50 minutes.
We're talking, and our interviews need to be shorter, which is kind of sad. But anyway, go ahead and check it out. It's 50 minutes. It's really good. Lots of things going on, and I hope you'll like it.
And let's get straight to the interview.
Now on to today's interview.
We're here with Dr. James Renahan. He is the Dean of the Institute of Reformed Baptist Studies, specializing, I'm sure you've heard of him, in Baptist history. And especially particular Baptist, Reformed Baptist history. Dr. Renahan, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
And before we get started with the questions we have, well, we have a set of standard questions we'd like to ask all our interviewees, and this will be real quick. First, why are you a Christian? Second, why are you Reformed? And third, why are you Baptist?
When I was 15 years old, some friends in my neighborhood invited me to their church, where I went and heard the gospel. It was in 1970, and after a struggle, I believed it. I was baptized in that church, interestingly on the same day that my wife was baptized, and through that church was nurtured in the faith and then sent off to Christian college. It was while I was at Christian college, freshman in a History of Western Civilization course, as the professor came to talk about the Reformation, that he described what he called as the 5 points of Calvinism. As I listened to them, I thought, well, that makes sense to me. I believe those things. If God is God, then God must be sovereign. That set me off to reading a lot of very fine books. The Banner of Truth back then was really the main source of Reformed books, and Walter Chantry's book, Today's Gospel, Authentic or Synthetic, was very helpful to me. Then Lorraine Bettner's book, The Reformed Doctrine of Predestination, Ian Murray, The Puritan Hope, and many, many others along the way that God used to help me to understand the Reformed faith. I'm a Baptist by conviction. It was through a Baptist church that I was brought to faith in Christ. I have not ever doubted the truths of believers' baptism since then, although I've taken seriously the challenge to investigate pedobaptism. I've read many fine books from a pedobaptist perspective, but have never been convinced that they teach us the truth of Scripture. And so by conviction, I'm a Baptist.
All right, excellent. Thank you. We want to talk about Baptist origins and why
are there different theories about Baptist origins? I hear a lot of them going about, and what are the different views held today?
Well, broadly speaking, there are three views of Baptist origins. One is called successionism, one is called the Anabaptist kinship theory, and the third is a view that's called the English separatist theory. And they have developed because of different presuppositions that drive men as they work their way through Scripture. In the 19th century, many, many Baptists were either successionists or they were of the Anabaptist kinship view. Successionism says that we are able to trace a lineage of Baptist churches all the way back to the apostles, either John the Baptist or Jesus and his apostles, and from Jesus and his apostles then to Paul, and then down through the ages to us. It's held mostly by churches that would identify themselves today as landmark Baptists. It's often called the landmark view. The second view, Anabaptist spiritual kinship, was a view that was championed by men like W.R. Estep, and it argues that there must be some kind of connection between the English Baptists and the Anabaptists of the continent, who preceded them by about 100 years. The third view is the English separatist view, which argues that Baptists, modern Baptists as we know them, developed out of English separatism in the first 40 years or so of the 17th century. Now, the reason that there are different views, the successionists would argue that there are certain texts of Scripture that require a view of successionism. Jesus said, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." Or Paul says that the church is the pillar and foundation of the truth. And they argue that a church is defined as a Baptist church. For the most part, they won't acknowledge the existence of any other kinds of churches. Only a Baptist church is a true church. And thus, if Jesus' words are true, that necessitates a continuous existence of Baptist churches, hence a succession from the apostolic age. So you could say that it's largely an exegetically driven view. I would dispute the exegesis of the text. I would also dispute the definition of a church as only a Baptist church. The Anabaptist kinship view arises because men say there must be some connection. We're talking about a group that originated on the continent of Europe around 1525, and we can demonstrate the existence of groups like that on the continent of Europe. Likewise, we find in the 16th century the word Anabaptist appearing in literature in England. And so there must be some kind of connection between these continental Anabaptists and the English Baptists of the 17th century. It's a kinship-driven view. It's a view that says, well, they practiced a form of believer's baptism, the Englishmen practiced a form of believer's baptism, they must have had some relationship to each other. The third view, the English separatist view, is a history-driven view. It's a view that argues, based upon the writings of the 17th century particular Baptists themselves, and it argues that there really is very little, if any, evidence of derivation that comes from the Anabaptists, rather that the English Baptists developed out of a climate of growing separatism, or what you could even call, I think, legitimately Puritanism in the English church.
Okay, right. So although there was some similarity in practice, there's a variety of beliefs and that led to that practice, right?
Well, the similarity is in some ways superficial. Most of the continental Anabaptists, for example, did not practice immersion. I think it can be demonstrated that some of them did, but most of them did not. Either they sprinkled or they would wash the face with a cloth or something like that. So, I mean, you did have a practice of believer's baptism, but it wasn't believer's baptism by immersion. Likewise, theologically, many, many differences. the Continental Area Baptists were largely pacifists. Very few of them got the doctrine of justification by faith correct. They would add works in one way or another back into the gospel. They tended not to come out of Rome in terms of soteriology, even though they came out of Rome in terms of ecclesiology. It's an interesting circumstance.
And you know what? So I live, well, all of us here, Confessing Baptists, we all live in the Fort Worth area, mm-hmm. the home of Southwestern. And they recently had a conference on Anabaptist. Could it be said that today's Baptists are descendants of Anabaptists? Could that be a true statement?
No, I think that's a gross overstatement.
Right. I remember a few years back when the Lutherans, Lutheran World Council, I believe, apologized to the Anabaptists for what they did, what their forefathers did. And so they apologized to, I think, a Mennonite groups.
Yeah, if modern Baptists were descendants of the Anabaptists, then we should all be Mennonites.
Right. Okay, so, right, and so that's one of the views held today.
It needs to be recognized that the General Baptists do have historical priority. And they were the first group of Englishmen to come to a conclusion that baptism was to be for believers. They, too, originated out of English separatism. Up in the north of England, there were a series of groups that met in some villages. Probably the most famous part of these groups are the Mayflower Pilgrims. John Robinson was their pastor, and they ended up coming, of course, to Plymouth and starting a Plymouth colony. And much of American history flows from that. But there were other groups that were affiliated with them up in the north of England, and one was led by two men, John Smith and Thomas Helwys. Like the Mayflower Pilgrims, it was necessary for them to flee to the Netherlands because of persecution. And while they were in the Netherlands, as they examined Scripture, they came to the conclusion that baptism should not be for babies, that it should only be for believers. Now, they were living in a culture, they were surrounded by Mennonites and other kinds of Dutch Anabaptists. But interestingly, they didn't go to them to receive baptism. What they did was, this fellow John Smith baptized himself. Sometimes you'll hear him referred to as John Smith the Sea Baptist, S-E-Baptist. That's the Latin word for self, and it means the self-baptizer. John Robinson, in his works, was horrified. He writes about John Smith and his action, and he was horrified that Smith was willing to do this on his own. The question was sort of, what right do you have, without any kind of succession, to reject your infant baptism that has come to you from a practice well known in the ages? What right do you have to proceed on your own and practice baptism by yourself? Well, that church, after Smith baptized himself, then others were baptized, and they reconstituted themselves. And though they were in the Netherlands, they need to be recognized as the first English Baptist church. After a little while, Smith felt the pressure of those criticisms, and he actually took a group and went off and finally joined the Mennonites. But the other part of his church, led by Thomas Helwys, believed that their action was a proper action, that all they needed was a warrant of command of Christ in Scripture. And they maintained their identity as a Baptist church and felt it was also necessary for them to return to England and establish a witness for their new cause in London. Now, Helwys had some relatives who were in favor at court. He had a cousin who was a knight and recognized by the king, and he thought that his family connections would protect him when he went back to England. So they moved back to England. It was 1612. They took up residence on the outskirts of London, and almost immediately Helwys was arrested, never came out of jail again. But the deed had been done. An indigenous Baptist church practicing believer's baptism was located in London. Now, they hadn't practiced immersion yet. They were probably practicing some kind of face washing with a cloth. But nevertheless, the deed was done. There they were. They're in England. And that really has to be recognized as the first English Baptist church. Over the next 20 or 30 years, there seem to be records of another two or three General Baptist churches appearing here and there in England. The records are spotty. We don't know for sure. There is a church that appears in the 1640s that it's thought is probably the continuation of Helwys's congregation, but we just don't know that for certain.
I had a quick question on what you're talking about. These early churches who first started, I guess, the self-baptism and baptizing, did they also, are they considered Baptists merely because their view of baptism changed, or did their church polity also change, or did that come later down the line as well?
No, there was at the same time a growing movement among these separatists towards Congregationalism. And I don't think it would be fair for us to look back and say that their polity was a full-blown Baptist polity in the way that it came to be developed, say, in 1675. But
right.
But still, they were, I think it's fair to recognize that they were well down the road. Largely it is believers' baptism that at this point qualifies them to be a Baptist church, but they're the only ones in the world in 1612. You see, that part of the fact that they're the first ones in the world in 1612, to go back to an earlier question, why are there different theories? Some people are not comfortable with the thought that for more than 1,000 years there were no churches that were practicing believers' baptism. They have to ask the question, what happened? Why is that? The successionists say, well, there must be, even if we don't know their names, they must have been in existence. I think that there are other ways that can be looked at. They themselves would have said, Israel went for centuries without observing the Passover, and then when they came back into the land after the exile, they did observe the Passover. That's a parallel to the problem of churches that didn't practice believers' baptism for a millennia.
Good point.
Exactly, and that's what the response that's in the appendix to our confession, the 1689 confession, that language is in there, and also it's in the preface to Hercules Collins' Orthodox Catechism, that same logic.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. In the UK, what is the difference between general Baptist and particular Baptist?
General Baptist is a term that's used to speak of a group of churches that are largely Arminian, self-consciously Arminian in their theology, and who held to a general atonement, that is, a belief that Christ died for all men at all times and in all places. The particular Baptists had a completely separate origin, a different beginning. There really aren't any connection between the two. One didn't come out of the other. And the particular Baptists got their name from the fact that they believed in a particular atonement, that is, that the purpose of God in sending His Son into the world to become a man, take on human flesh, and to die in the place of sinners, was that the elect would be redeemed, that God's intention in sending His Son was to say that He die on behalf of His elect and not for all of the sins of all men of all time.
You want to talk to us a little bit about, the context of particular Baptists? So they grew up, so they were born in that period. What was the political climate like for them during this time?
Well, that's really a good question. The history of the Reformation in England is a fascinating one. It's very different from the history of the Reformation in the cities and city-states in continental Europe, largely because England was a nation in a way that most of the other countries weren't. They were a conglomeration of city-states, where England, being an island, had defined borders, and even though Scotland was still on the island, there was a defined border between England and Scotland. So you had a nation ruled by a king as over against city-states that are ruled by smaller dukes or electors or even city councils in the case of some of the Swiss cities. And England's reformation largely depended over the years on the whims and fancies of whoever was the monarch. When it was Henry VIII, it was a halfway reformation. When it was Edward VI, his only son, there was good hope that it would move forward very quickly. When Edward died as a teenager and Mary came to the throne, it was a reversion back to Romanism. Then along came Elizabeth with her via media, the halfway, the middle reformation. And when Elizabeth died, never having married and childless, and James I came to the throne in 1603, the Puritans had a real hope that further reformation would be found. They requested a conference. It was held at Hampton Court Palace, which is a beautiful Tudor palace just south of London. And they hoped that James would be amenable to their requests for moving forward and making the Church of England more like the churches of the continent. He was quite unwilling. He's famous for four words that he spoke at that conference, and they were no bishop, no king. He recognized that the Episcopalian structure of the Church of England provided a means of direct control over the church. You know, theoretically, the whole nation assembled in the churches every week. You were required by law at that point to attend the Church of England. And so attendance could be taken if the officers of each of the parish churches were willing. You could keep track of the population. You could know if there were any dissenting groups. You could squash them pretty quickly. Likewise, it was the greatest means of communication that the king had with the nation. You know, theoretically, if everybody was there, in the space of about 2 weeks, a royal proclamation could be sent to the furthest parish in the country, and it could be read out at that worship service of the church on Sunday. He was not amenable to forward reformation, and you had groups fleeing to the Netherlands. Ultimately, you had groups fleeing to the New World. He died in 1625, followed to the throne by his son Charles I. And Charles was married to a Roman Catholic, was sympathetic to Arminianism, began to change the climate of the Church of England itself. He appointed a man named William Laud to the position of Archbishop of Canterbury. That's the top position in the Church of England. And Laud began a systematic process of persecuting the Puritans who were in the Church of England. And you know that there are two important theological planks, in a sense, to William Laud's program for the church. One of them is what I call aggressive Arminianism. If you read the 39 articles of the Church of England, which are their doctrinal standard, they're largely strongly Calvinistic. In fact, J.C. Ryle referred to his church as the Reformed Church of England because of the content of the 39 articles. But when William Laud was Archbishop of Canterbury, he made it illegal to interpret them in any kind of Calvinistic or predestinarian sense. And of course, that incensed the Puritans, the Calvinistic Puritans in the Church of England. The second thing that he did, his second plank, was to introduce what I call high church sacerdotalism back into the church. Now, sacerdotalism is a technical theological word that means that grace comes through physical acts. The dispensing of grace comes through physical acts, and especially baptism. His doctrine of infant baptism is almost indistinguishable from the Roman Catholic doctrine of infant baptism, where when the water is applied to the body of the child, the baby, grace enters the heart, and the process of becoming a Christian is begun. Well, that incensed the Puritans as well, and it happened in the 1630s, at this time when there was an illegal church that had emerged in London in 1616, and that illegal church was struggling with the question of baptism in its midst. Let me tell you about that church. It's called the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church, from the names of the first three pastors. You know, back then, churches weren't called Heritage Baptist Church or First Baptist Church or Gurney Road Baptist Church or anything like that. They were just the church that met at such and such a place. And historians have frequently named churches after the leaders. Well, Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church formed in 1616 as something of a separatist church in London because people were growing quite unhappy with the persecuting policies of James I and of Charles I. In 1633, they faced a real issue in their church, and the question was, can we bring our infants down to the local parish church to have them baptized? Now, this was not a theoretical issue for them. In order for children to be legitimized, to be able to inherit, their baptisms, not their births, but their baptisms would be recorded in the church register. And that would give them legal standing politically to do things like inherit property from their parents. And some of the members of the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church were merchants with some property in the city of London, and they had to face the question, can we in good conscience take our babies down there to be baptized? Up to that point, they had apparently done that, but there was a growing separatist wing within the church that was very uncomfortable with what was happening in the Church of England, with the innovations that were being introduced by William Laud, and they started saying, no, we can't. No, we can't do this. We're not comfortable with it. It's against our conscience. It violates our principles. So in 1633, you had a separation in that church, in which the continuing congregation was able to satisfy their conscience that they could bring their babies down to the local parish minister and have them baptized and enrolled. But the stricter group said, no, we can't do that any longer. We have to baptize our babies by ourselves. And so you have the question of the legitimacy of the administrator of baptism being addressed in the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church. So you have this climate in that church in which there are questions about baptism, infant baptism, that are being discussed and debated, and you have a separation that takes place in 1633. Well, 5 years later, in this same church, the question of baptism comes up again. But this time it's not, should we take our babies down to the local parish to be baptized? It's, should we baptize our babies at all? And in that congregation, again, the matter is debated at length, and there's another separation that takes place, this time with a group of people who leave them, believing that it's wrong to baptize babies at all. And so now you have another Baptist church that's formed. This is 1638. It's led by a man named John Spilsbury, and that church is formed on the principle of believer's baptism. Now, it's different from the general Baptists that have been in existence since 1612, because it's a church that's formed on a very strongly predestinarian or Calvinistic convictions about soteriology. It doesn't have any relationship to the earlier general Baptists. It doesn't come out of them. It develops out of this milieu of Calvinistic separatism in England, in London, and so you have a particular Baptist church that develops in 1638. Now, they're still not practicing immersion, but there they are.
Sure, sure. So all this is really about them, and we have a lot of records on them, but how much did they write themselves, these earlier Baptists?
Oh, okay, yeah. The beginning of their writing is in the early 1640s. And we have, at this point, we have quite a bit of material that they wrote. Probably in 5 minutes, if I took the time, I could tell you approximately how many books there were that they published on the question of baptism. And you know, most of their early works have to do with baptism or matters related to baptism, such as the purity of the church. One of the early problems that led some of the men into believers' baptism was the fact that they were forced to administer the Lord's Supper indiscriminately to the Church of England congregation where they served. This was the question for a man named Benjamin Cox. He was a minister in the Church of England, but he came to the conclusion that the Lord's table needed to be protected. It needed to be guarded from the immoral or the people in his parish who didn't profess faith. He came to the conclusion that they shouldn't be allowed to come to the table. Now, as W.T. Whitley, a famous Baptist, English Baptist historian, said, when you come to the conclusion that you have to protect the table, it's not much further of a step to come to the conclusion that you also have to protect baptism and that you ought to give baptism only to believers. So, you know, your question is a really good one. You have this climate in the Church of England where William Laud is enforcing a sacramental view of infant baptism. You have a church in London that's struggling with the question of the legitimacy of the administrators of baptism. You have an anti-Calvinistic development in the Church of England, and all of these things together are pressing in on the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church, and then still on John Spilsbury and his congregation, and you have out of that context the development of particular Baptist practice and belief.
You know, that's funny that you say that. I was reading Alexander Carson's testimony of switching from Irish Presbyterian to a Baptist, and that was one of the reasons was the Lord's Supper. Mm-hmm. So that's a good quote. You know, it's not that far of a step once you start looking at the Lord's table.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, and that's our purpose, isn't it? It's to seek to keep these things as faithfully as we're able to do so in a way that honors Christ.
So we talked about the JLJ Church. We talked about Helwys, I believe it's pronounced.
Yep.
You're in the 1640s now. What happens in 1644? How did that come about? How did our 1641st London Baptist Confession come about?
Yeah, well, you know, the 1640s were a very dangerous time in London, especially. You had Parliament and King at war with each other. You had a disruptive political circumstance in which Parliament is rejecting the religious impositions of William Laud and the King, but there are many other circumstances, and they enter into a war. But at the same time, you have a group of men in London who think that, or who know the story of the Anabaptists on the continent, places like Munster, which was an absolute disaster. And they hear of a group of churches in London who are practicing something that looks similar to this practice of Munster. And they are very concerned about it. And they begin to publish some really interesting works about the history of Munster and how bad Anabaptists are. And the whole purpose is to smear the reputation of this little group of churches that's developing in their midst. And because of that, because the situation was very, very dangerous and very difficult, and these churches were technically illegal, they wanted to find a way to demonstrate to the people around them that they were orthodox, that they shouldn't be considered like the Anabaptists from the continent. They had a completely different origination. They didn't have a relationship with them. Their theological convictions were not like those Anabaptists, but they were pretty much the same as the orthodox men in London. And they did what most groups have done. They figured that the best way to demonstrate this was to write a confession of faith. And so the seven churches of London came together. Now, we don't know what the mechanism was. Some have thought that John Spilsbury was the leading voice behind the confession, and I think that that's as good of a surmise as any. We just don't know. But The seven churches had representatives signing it. There were 14 or 15 names that were attached to it, and it was printed publicly and distributed in 1644. In fact, a couple of the pastors actually went to the door of the Houses of Parliament and sought to distribute copies of the confession to the members of Parliament, hoping that they would read them and enact some kind of toleration for the Baptist churches. But it was an attempt to say, we believe what is orthodox, we believe largely the same thing as you do. Please, we're not like the Anabaptists, don't persecute us. In modern language, they're kind of saying, give us a break. Take it easy on us. Listen to what we say. We're not bad people.
You know, speaking of the 1644, some people in the Americas, I'm thinking of the U.S. and Canada, North America, believe that, well, they follow a system, a doctrine known as New Covenant Theology. Is that something that they can do, claim that history with the 1644 Confession of Faith?
Well, you know, we could do a whole podcast on this. The simple answer is no way, not in any way. Let me put it in capital letters. If it wasn't bad for the microphone, I'd shout it. No way. That's a complete misunderstanding of the confession. There's so much that I could say that I just shake my head. It's hard for me to even think about the fact that people are still holding on to that. I mean, we've done so much work. There's all kinds of things that have been published to demonstrate that there's just no basis in reality or fact to that view.
Excellent. And then, okay, so 1644, and as you said, they were going down to Parliament, where I believe the Westminster Divines were meeting and passing their confession out there to let them know that we are in agreement with you all.
Well, so, yeah, remember that the Westminster Divines were meeting actually at Westminster Chapel, which is very close to the Houses of Parliament, but they are two different places. So we must not confuse that. The Baptists went down to the Houses of Parliament and sought to distribute the copies to the members of Parliament, not to the Westminster Assembly.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. And then, so at this time, the Westminster Standards had not yet been published.
Right.
And so so the Baptists had done their 1644, I guess, from their own sources.
Well, yeah, what they did was they every good confession uses something else as its basis. You don't just sit down and all by yourself decide that you're the most insightful theologian of the Christian era and write a confession. And so what they used was the True Confession of 1596. It was probably written by Henry Ainsworth. It came from a separatist church, a British church that fled persecution and ended up in the Netherlands. About half of the First London Confession comes from the True Confession. Then they used some other sources as well. There was another separatist document published in England in 1603 called The Points of Difference. They used a good bit of material from William Ames's Marrow of Theology. Ames is very, very important for a particular Baptist theological history. And then I've argued in print that they also probably were responding to some works, Puritan-era works from the 1640s that had been published against them, and that they were using those other works as a foil for what they wrote in the chapters on baptism.
And I believe there was a revision to the first Confession of Faith. Is that correct?
Yeah. In 1644, the first confession was criticized by a man named Daniel Featley. Dr. Featley was a member of the Westminster Assembly. And in print, in a fascinating book called The Dippers Dipped, which is, among other things, a record of a debate that he had in London with some of the early particular Baptists. But in that book, he criticized the first edition of the First London Confession. And so they revised it, and they actually, interestingly enough, they changed everything in one way or another. Every criticism that he made of them, they changed. Even some of the criticisms he made about believers' baptism, they sort of, I don't know if I want to say they watered down the language, but they made it, they tried to make it somewhat more acceptable even to pedo-Baptist objections. And that's the 1646 version that's actually, it's probably more commonly available to us today than is the first edition of 1644.
Okay, and then, so Westminster reminds me, they published their work in 1646 or so, 1646, 1647.
Yeah.
And then we have our second London Baptist Confession of Faith, but this time, unlike before, where they signed the document, they didn't sign this. Well, why is that?
It's in 1677. You know, it's an interesting little oddity of history that we talk about the 1689 confession, but so far as we know, it was never actually printed in 1689. It was printed in 1677, 88, and 99. The reason it's called the 1689 is that there was a general assembly of about 108 churches in London in September of that year, and that assembly adopted and recommended the confession, and that's why it's called the 1689. But anyways, in 1677, the fires of persecution were coming upon the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians, and all of the Baptists. And political circumstances were such that it would have been very, very dangerous for them to identify themselves. In 1644 and in 1646, when there were names attached, it was a brave step, but it wasn't potentially dangerous. It wasn't a potentially deadly step. But in 1677, it might have been. And so they didn't publish their names with it at that point.
Okay, so this is 1640, 1677. In 1620, the Mayflower sailed.
Mm-hmm.
How did Baptists come to America? Were they on the Mayflower, maybe, or how did they come to America?
Well, you know, the reason I'm laughing is my wife is a Mayflower descendant, and so of course my kids are. I'm not, but she is, and my kids are. And her family has an amazing history. She's actually in a direct line descendant from a man who was an elder in the Second Baptist Church that was ever formed in Rhode Island around 1650.
Now they were
not Baptists on the Mayflower. No, there weren't any Baptists there. But around 1639 or 1640, you have the same kind of thing happening on this side of the pond that happened over there. You have men who are taking their commitment to Scripture one step further. See, they're asking the question, in a sense, the Reformation did a good thing and it moved forward the life of the church, but it perhaps was incomplete. And they're asking the question, is there anything else about the Reformation that needed to be finished? And the answer, of course, was believers' baptism in the doctrine of the church. So you had Roger Williams, who was the first of the Baptists in America. And then after him, the Second Baptist Church, which was in Newport, Rhode Island, and that's my wife's family's old church, was founded by a man named John Clark. Now, these churches in Rhode Island, and then there was one in Swansea, Massachusetts, which is not far from Newport. It's on the south coast of Massachusetts. These churches very clearly regarded themselves as extensions of the movement that was going on in England. The Swansea Mass Church was actually a migration from a particular Baptist church that had begun in Wales. And you may know in Wales there's a town called Swansea, and it's not surprising that in the Plymouth Colony, these Baptists, when they came over, named their town Swansea because of their connection to the old country. When the Baptists appear in Boston, when they appear in Kittery, Maine, all of these early 17th century churches in New England, they all have ties, very, very formal and very direct ties to the particular Baptist churches in England. We know that many of the early members had been immigrants who had come over. They had been part of churches in London or in the countryside of England or Wales, and they were sort of the men who brought with them the foundations of Baptist churches. There's also a really interesting story about the formation of the First Baptist Church of Boston. The first president of Harvard College was a man named Henry Dunster. And Dunster, in his study of Scripture, came to the conclusion that infant baptism was not correct. There's so much to say in so little time. Let me back up and tell you a little bit of the family story, okay?
All right.
The church in Newport had three elders, John Clark, a man named Obadiah Holmes, and my wife's ancestor, John Crandall. These three men went up to Lynn, Massachusetts, which is a little town just north of Boston. One of the members from their church, an old blind man, lived up there in Lynn, and they went up to visit him. On the Sunday, when they were there, they didn't go to the Puritan Congregational Church in Lynn, but they held a service in this old blind man's home. And they were arrested. They were interrupted while they were having the service, and they were arrested. Now, the reason they were arrested is that they weren't attending the public worship of the established church, the state church in Lynn. They were brought to trial, and they were punished. Crandall and Clark were fined, and Holmes was fined, and Holmes refused to pay the fine, or he refused to let anyone pay it for him, and so he was publicly whipped at the old state house in Boston. Now, some of the men, some of the Puritans who witnessed that began to think about the question of infant baptism, and Henry Dunster, president of Harvard College, was one of them. As a result of seeing Oliver Holmes's whipping and thinking through the issues, he came to reject infant baptism, made that known to the overseers of Harvard College, and was fired from his position. It was the autumn. He had just built himself a home on the property of Harvard College for his young family, and they turned him out. They forced him out from this home that he himself had built, and so he had to go somewhere else. Winter's coming on. It's the worst time of year. He ended up in Duxbury, Mass., which is just north of Plymouth. But that was the beginning of the First Baptist Church of Boston. He was followed by some other people who were his friends, and they became the nucleus of that church. It's fascinating stories, and in a sense, it's my wife's family history. You know, I look at my sons, who are now Reformed Baptist pastors, and I think what a great heritage they have, because one of the most famous stories of American Baptist history is the story of their family. But they were all directly related to these English particular Baptists in their origination.
That's really interesting. I was told in school that people came here for religious freedom, but I didn't know that Baptists were being persecuted here in the colonies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, we're out of time. I want to thank you for your time with us. And just a couple of closing questions. First of all, to our listeners, I want to recommend to you all to get from Reformed Baptist Academic Press, Dr. Renahan's True Confessions. It is our Confessions of Faith, our catechisms, the Orthodox Catechism, the Baptist Catechism, and then there are sources, the source documents as well, and they're in parallel column format, so be sure to get that. And Dr. Renahan, any other resources you could recommend?
People might be interested in my book, Edification and Beauty, which is a study of the early ecclesiology of particular Baptists. It's available from Amazon.com. All you have to do is search my name, and that should come up. I sent to Jason earlier today a link that I was part of a sort of an online debate about Baptist origins, and I sent him a link to one of the papers that I've written that handles that question. I'm sure that there's other things that I could mention, but they're not coming to mind right now.
Okay, and what's next for you? What's coming up? Are you speaking anywhere soon? I know you speak throughout the year at various conferences, and what's going on in Dr. Renahan's world?
Oh, yeah. Next time I'm speaking somewhere will be end of May at the Chinese Evangelical Church in San Diego. Then in June, I'll be at the Reformed Baptist Family Conference in Eastern Pennsylvania for a week. And then in the fall, hope to go to England and teach for a week in Northern England on the Confession. I'm working on my exposition of the Confession. Hope to keep working at that. It'll be a long-term project, but I'd like to see it out in a year or two. Other than that, busy here in Escondido and thankful to God for what he's doing, both at the Institute of Reformed Baptist Studies and in the church where I serve. Great things are happening.
Great, excellent. And I just thought of something when you were speaking about England. I've been following you for a while, you know, online, and you did a tour. I think it was a particular Baptist tour of England at one time. You plan on doing that again?
Well, I'd like to do that again, but next year, June of 2014, we are planning to do a Reformation tour of Germany, Switzerland, and France. And it looks really great. We'll start out in Berlin, but then go into Wittenberg and see all the Luther sites, and then down to Zurich and Geneva, and then end in Paris. We'll go to Strasbourg. There's information on that on the IRBS Facebook page, but I would be glad to put anybody who's interested in touch with the people who are taking care of that. I think it's going to fill up pretty quickly. We're only taking 50 people, and that'll be a great time. But that's, God willing, June of 2014.
Okay, and any closing statements?
Thanks for having me on, and great to talk to you, brothers. Thankful for all you're doing, and if you'd like, I'm glad to do this again.
Oh, we would love to. We would love to.
Yeah, definitely. I already have like four or five topics I can think of. So we will definitely be bugging you later about those.
All right, good.
Awesome. And then the last thing, did you want to close with the reading of one of those hymns yet?
Sure. I'll read to you this hymn, God in the Gospel of His Son, written by Benjamin Bedome, a little-known Baptist pastor from Burton-on-the-Water, which is in the Cotswolds in England. Spent about 50 years in this little village with a tremendous ministry, just a wonderful ministry in the 18th century. He deserves a lot better publicity than he's received. But this hymn is in the Trinity hymnal. It's a well-known hymn. I'll read to you the six stanzas here. God in the Gospel of His Son makes His eternal counsels known. 'Tis here His richest mercy shines, and truth is drawn in fairest lines. Here sinners of an humble frame may taste His grace and learn His name. 'Tis written characters of blood, severely just, immensely good. Here Jesus in 10,000 ways His soul-attracting charms displays, recounts His poverty and pains, and tells His love in melting strains. Wisdom it dictates here imparts, to form our minds, to cheer our hearts. Its influence makes the sinner live, it bids the drooping saints revive. Our raging passion it controls, and comfort yields to contrite souls. It brings a better world in view, and guides us all our journey through. May this blessed volume ever lie close to my heart and near my eye, the life's last hour my soul engage, and be my chosen heritage. Amen.
Headlines for the week.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. So, as I said, I think in the interview, just to let you all know, I have been following on the internet Dr. Renahan for quite some time.
You mean stalking him?
That's what I wanted to know. I said
internet stalking.
When I asked him, you know, I told him, I said, I've been following you for years. Is that creepy? Does that sound creepy? Do you think I creep him out? Because, you know, I don't want to, you know, creep him out.
Well, he did say he'd come back and do some more shows. So
okay, well, that's good.
It wasn't that creepy.
Like, as soon as I uttered that, I was like, oh, wow, that's creepy. but thanks for listening to him. Thanks for sticking to
it. It would have been worse if you said, like, in my mom's basement, I've been following you for years while eating Cheetos and Mountain Dew.
Right.
Play some D&D. What is that?
What?
Nothing. You don't know what D&D is?
No.
Are you serious? Come on.
Okay, any listener, if you know what D&D is, plus 5 nerd points.
Yeah, plus 5.
And for everyone who knows what it is, Javi gets negative 10 nerd points.
There you go.
What is D&D?
So that we'll put that in the comments.
I'm not going to say.
Yeah, we'll put it in the comments. Okay, so...
Is it like a World of Warcraft thing?
No.
Anyway, stop interrupting Junior.
Interrupting. Okay, so going on to news. I didn't have that many posts this week. I'm trying to link to conferences Baptists have, particular 1689 Baptists have done on Covenant Theology. So I put up an ARMCA conference on Covenant Theology, a Southwest Founders conference on Covenant Theology, and then on Monday you will see the Georgia Association of Confessing Baptists, their conference they had a while back on Covenant Theology. Good listeners, check them out. And also, let's see, on Friday, I found a hymn by Isaac Watts about the law, as quoted by Ernest Kevin, but Ernest Kevin didn't say who wrote it or what the title of hymn was. I Googled it. I searched it. Can I say Google?
Yeah.
Okay, they're not paying us. When someone say I searched for it on the online.
Everyone is like Google. They Google something.
Google's
on the interwebs.
Synonymous with searching.
Right. So yeah, I searched. Yeah. Okay, I searched.
Even if you binged it. AltaVista, everyone just Googles. I Yahooed it.
Since they're not paying me, I don't want to say that I Googled it, but I searched for something on the online. And so I searched for the hymn online, and I found out that it's in a couple of old Baptist hymn books. So the first one I posted last Friday was The Psalmist, and that was John L. Daggs and R.B.C. Howe. They endorsed that psalm book. So that's something good hymns on there. Check it out. It's a free PDF. And then since Renahan was discussing Baptist origins with us just recently, I posted a couple of things from Prager Baptist. One was the appendix to our Confession of Faith, the 1689 Confession of Faith, talks about the origins of Baptists. You know, were they a new thing? Was it something new? Was it a landmarkism? Did we come down from, you know, John the Baptist, or was it a recovery? Like if you're familiar with Calvin's Institutes, he wrote a preface to the King, a letter to the King of France, and he says the gospel is not new. Talking about the Reformation, the gospel isn't new. It's new to these papists, but it's not new, right? And so the same thing with Baptists. The baptism upon a profession, immersion upon your profession isn't new, it's a recovery. And the same thing with Hercules Collins's Orthodox Catechism. He also said that in his preface to his catechism. And then, I think, was that it? Oh, one more thing I wanted to say. So when we were doing this interview with Dr. Renahan, we had some you'll mention that we had some listeners other than Javi and yourself on there. And I think one of them was Sam Renahan over a particular Voices Speak. I say that
because
he posted the dippers dipped, and I think we posted. Oh. We posted that. Remember that?
When you're talking about it, yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about Daniel Featley's dippers dipped, and
I was going to post.
I saw that.
I haven't queued it to post this week.
Oh, you haven't posted it yet?
Yeah, I haven't posted it yet. It's queued up though.
I posted his quote on the covenant of grace.
Yes,
I saw that.
That's good. But yeah, so Daniel Featley.
Oh, I guess I'll say that later.
But I thought it was interesting because Renahan had Sam Renahan had to blur out some of the images cover the blood.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and he was like, how can he take this even seriously
right.
as a polemic? So, yeah, that was it for me. Good week, good interview with Dr. Renahan. Look forward to interviewing him again if I didn't freak him out too much. And hopefully we'll get to interview, you know, Nick Needham, Dr. Nick Needham, Michael Renahan, Michael Haken, I'm sorry. Maybe Michael Renahan, too.
Yeah, hey.
Yeah, him.
Hey.
On John Toombs and Tom Nettles. And Tom Nettles comes here pretty frequently. So we'll get a
you know what I really want to talk about?
Who's that? I'm done with
it. I mean, I want someone to talk about the regular Baptist, separate Baptist distinction.
Oh, is that a lead-in for, is that a teaser for next week? Or?
Oh, well, that's a great teaser for next week.
wait for it. Wait for it. All right, well, this is Jason. As always, I post a lot of stuff based on what our podcast was. So last week I posted a lot of stuff regarding baptism. Some debates on baptism and some writings on it. I don't do that exclusively, but I do tend to post more on that. But the three things I wanted to highlight, one of them was a pretty exciting announcement from Dr. James Renahan, who's over there at the Institute of Reformed Baptist Studies at Westminster Seminary, California. Oh, well, he was on the show today, so mm-hmm. You already know that. Anyways, he had posted this. With great hope for its usefulness, the Institute of Reformed Baptist Studies has developed a continuing education program for pastors or men being mentored by pastors. We have developed a curriculum that will deepen an understanding of Scripture and usefulness in the church. These are studies intended to help pastors and potential church leaders taught by skilled men. So this is a real exciting announcement they had. So I will, as always, we will, every link we talk about here will be on our show notes, will be on the page about this, so go check it out. There's lots of good stuff they have there, just to kind of give you a little taste of what they're offering. The Institute of Reformed Baptist Studies Continuing Education Program has a wide selection of courses leading to a certificate, ranging from exegetical courses to systematic theology, and from church history to pastoral theology. Every course will be available in both video and audio format. Each is appropriately resource to support learning and knowledge. Our program provides not only an ideal environment for continuing education, but also a superb opportunity to grow in usefulness. So I think this is a really great position, because just last week, that Nicholas Alford post I was talking about with Spurgeon and Dabb on the calling of men and how Reformed Baptist churches need more men to be called. And this is a great resource to train up these men. So definitely check that out. I also posted another great resource, and this comes from Reformed Baptist Seminary. These are lectures on preaching and teaching. So this is just pure homiletics right here, taught by Robert Briggs, Brian Borgman, and Robert Elliott. And it is 20 lessons. They range everything from preaching, definition and observation on preaching, the message we preach, the power of preaching, directives to young preachers, sermon classifications, choosing a passage to preach, preaching and contextualization, that's a three-part one, developing a passage to preach, outlining and preparation, delivering the message, and a Q&A session. Actually, it winds up being 24 total audio, so that's a huge resource right there for anyone wanting to study preaching or teaching.
Homiletics.
Yep, some good pastoral theology. I always include homiletics in pastoral theology, because that is one of the things that pastors do, so some people might not do that. But anyways, that is available, and when we did send that out, did post that, RBS actually tweeted at us saying that stay tuned, because videos for all these are coming as well. So,
oh, cool.
So that was really cool of them, and we look forward to that, and thank you to them for making this hugely valuable resource free. And finally, I did also want to point out another good solid ground book sale they're having. It's a $5 book sale, and I know after this sale, I think I spent about 20 or 25 bucks. Just because there are some books in there that I wanted to read. Let me just highlight some of the books in there. There's probably about close to 20. Some of the ones of particular interest may be An Introduction to the Baptist. That's by
Errol Hulse.
Good guy. Junior approves of him.
That's a free book.
No, not free.
You gotta listen. $5 sell. But that is a 67% discount.
Right.
It's $5?
Yes.
For real.
No. After this, do you check the website? Do you read your own website? Just kidding. That was hobby. After that, I think I spent 20 or 25 bucks on these, because some of them you can't find anywhere else either.
Sale's still going on.
The sale is still going on. I did check this morning. It is still going. So, of course, I always check to make sure, but it seems like it's going on for a while. Another one by Jeffrey Johnson, Behind the Bible, It's a Primer on Textual Criticism, at 60% off.
How do we know that name, Jeffrey Johnson?
Fatal flaw
of infant baptism, baby. Right. Yeah. That's right. Infant baptism, baby. It's when it's a baby. Anyways, he has another book he has on sale for $5 on there, is The Church, Why Bother? Ooh. Nature, Purpose, and Functions of the Local Church.
I need to get that, and we're going to interview him on that.
I bought that one. And you know ecclesiology is my pet doctrine right now, so as soon as that comes in, I'll be reading that. A book by Andrew Fuller, 55% off, The Backslider, His Nature, Symptoms, and Recovery. And Andrew Fuller would know about that, because there was a long period of his life where he did, quote-unquote, backslide, like, really hard. So, Benjamin Keach, The Marrow of True Justification, or Justification Without Works, at 60% off, so $5.
That is required reading, I think, by Jim Renahan, and I can't give you a link to that, but he has there's a list of required particular Baptist readings, that's one of them.
Benjamin Keach's?
Mm-hmm. This book right here.
That would be a good post to do.
Okay. Required reading. Okay.
Yeah. Come Ye Children. By Charles Spurgeon. Yeah. A book for parents and teachers on the Christian training children, and The Secrets of Communion with God, Matthew Henry. That's 60% off. So again, that's just a taste of all the other books they have on sale. Those are the more particularly Baptist ones. So there are some other great ones out there, stuff by Calvin, a lot more by Spurgeon. So check it out, and we'll move on to Javi when he's ready.
She's got this one.
I'm pulling up the website.
Your mom text you?
I was a little bit better this week. Last week I wasn't. I was not as good at posting. I posted a few links. There was an article that I found at BaptistTheology.com by Greg Welty. It's called "From Circumcision to Baptism," and it's just sort of.
Didn't I reference that in our first interview?
Did you?
Why we're Baptists? Yeah.
Like, really?
Yeah, Greg Welty and the other guy who I don't want to say because he's. He's anonymous. He's anonymous. Two of my biggest influences are Greg. That little paper, that white paper.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Why did you link to it then?
He asked me to. I have
that. Okay. Our very first interview, or our very first podcast,
yeah.
I posted the link and then I found another one at Founders that I posted, and it was by Greg Welty as well.
Yeah.
And some really good stuff. I also posted a link to. We are now on iTunes, I use a podcast app, and so I posted a link to my favorite podcast app. It's called Pocket Cast. It's $4 though on the Play Store.
$3.99.
Yeah. So instead, I also linked to a few free ones. If you guys have any suggestions, let me know. We can put those up. I know Jason just streamed the podcast from his Feedly account,
yep.
But that's not on his phone.
Yeah, I can.
It is on his phone.
Yeah, my phone.
You can also do your phone.
Yes.
Okay. Well, then maybe you can. I don't do that. I like the tile look on Pocket Cast. Like I said, it's really pretty. That was my favorite picture. Dude.
Are you going to mention this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. So then I found an article by Mark Chansky about babies. What's it called? Do You Really Know Your Newborn? It's an excerpt from his book, Manly Dominion.
The best part of it is the picture.
The picture, yeah.
It has a baby with tattoos on it. It's a love and hate, and it's holding out his fist, and it's hardcore.
Yeah, it's freaking funny.
It's worth it just looking at the picture.
Yeah, the picture cracked me up.
When I woke up that morning and saw your post, I was like, only Hollywood post. It's so good.
And so it's an article that just talks about total depravity in children from his book. And then... Oh, the symbolics lectures at IRBS, they're free. I posted, James Renahan actually used his Google Plus.
I know, I saw
it. Oh, did he?
After, yeah. Okay. Because we got him to get one, right? Like, yeah, we're the ones who made him get one.
Yeah.
All Baptists must be on Google Plus.
That's how we
and
record.
They're still not paying us.
Yeah. And we're not paying them for anything. He used it. I found it because I regularly check my Google Plus, unlike the rest of the world. So I linked to it. The lectures, I'll just read to it. It says, you're invited to attend the 2013 IRBS Symbolics class to be offered August 20th through the 30th this year on the campus of Westminster Seminary, California, Escondido. Lectures will be held Tuesday through Friday of each week. Baptist Symbolics is a study of the importance of confessions of faith in Baptist life. It begins with some historical material, considers various views of confessional subscription,
we'll talk about that in a minute.
And then focuses on the First London Confession of 1644-46 and the Second London Confession of 1787-89. We will expand both of these confessions in detail. Pastors and church leaders are invited to audit the course for only $50 through a generous gift from the Foundation for the Advancement of Reformed Baptist Courses. Students registered in the IRBS continuing education program may take the course for CEP credit for free.
And free
limited free housing is available on a first-come, first-served basis.
It's so epic.
Why not join us for these 2 weeks? For more information, please contact Professor Renahan at irbsoffice@gmail.com. So feel free to shoot him an email if you have any more questions. He's a really nice guy. Right?
Yeah, wouldn't take advantage of that.
Right. Yeah, I want to send their pastor there.
I know, right?
You know, one of the things we need to do with Renahan or
stop stalking him?
Well, that's one of the things I need to do.
Well, you know,
but it is to talk about different levels of confessional subscription. For example, Can I take out Chapter 7 of the Confession of Faith and still call myself a 1689er?
No.
I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good I think that's a good discussion, because I think we will have him on that topic.
Yeah.
And we'll definitely dive into
there's
that.
There's another guy I know on there's, system, but he's one of them.
There's a lecture that I just listened to yesterday.
You're posted this week, right?
I'll post it today.
Okay.
I'll post it tomorrow, something today or tomorrow. It's on the layers of subscription.
Yeah, like 7 layers of
subscription. Yeah.
So it starts with Renahan. It was from 2005.
Is it Renahan?
It starts with him. And I don't think he hands the mic over to...
Is it Renahan?
I thought it was.
It didn't sound
we'll
like
find out when we'll post it.
We'll find out later.
Whatever. Yeah, but it's...
it was really good.
Yeah,
it was really good.
It's good.
I heard it. We both sent it to our pastor. It's that stuff we've been talking about, obviously.
Then right. Samuel Renahan.
Yes.
Right. PettyFrance.wordpress.com. Posted a picture of
a page
from about a quote from his
that is all he does on
which is really cool though. I like it.
Yeah.
And it's about the new covenant, the nature of the new covenant, which is a steady stream.
I see you spelled church wrong.
Bro, I was typing so quick, dude. Will you fix that?
I'll do it right now.
And, we've had a steady stream of covenant theology.
From Robert Purnell.
It's from Robert Purnell's book, A Little Cabinet Richly Stored.
I love the titles back then.
Yeah, like,
we need to bring those back. Like, we should start changing our episode titles to,
today's
episode with Dr. James Renahan, and then, you know, 20 paragraphs.
Yeah.
But, and then I posted... David Jerizzo in our interview with them mentioned that the lectures or the sermons were stored on sermon audio somewhere. And so it was kind of hard to find them because I was kept searching buildings, miles, churches, and I couldn't find it. So I had to actually find the church name and then find the lectures. So I posted all of the lectures that were available from 2009 up to 2012. And then also included the brief interview that we had with them sort of promoting the conference. You guys check it out. And that's it for me. And I'm sorry I sound so
sleepy.
Yeah, weird today.
There you go. All right, now we're going to get on to a preview of next week's podcast with Paul Brewster.
You should do that one day instead of like actually playing the music.
Just have us in the music.
Yeah. We talked to Paul Brewster, pastor of Rikers Ridge Baptist Church. This was regarding an article, a response that he made entitled, Who Forgot What? A Reply to Emir Kantor. Emir Kantor delivered an address to a conference in Georgia Baptist history. It was really interesting. We also got into Sandy Creek and other stuff. So take a listen.
Next week's episode.
I would like to say I certainly have nothing personal against Dr. Kantor. I've never met him. He and I would probably be more kindred spirits in more ways than we're not. But certainly there were some things in that article that I felt needed to be challenged. It was by one person described as a spirited response. Maybe I was too cheeky in the title, but I was kind of raised with a model of scholarship that you put out a thesis, you support it as best you can, and you expect people to interact with it. So what Dr. Kantor propounded in that article was a very bold statement about Anabaptist origins, and I simply felt like that needed to be challenged, and I had hoped, perhaps, that he would respond, and I would invite him or anybody to respond, and you know, if I am mistaken in any way, show me. I think that's how scholarship moves forward, is somebody writes something and people critique it, and either it gets affirmed or it gets rejected. And I do believe that Kantor's article is just simply not adequate at a couple of levels.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Confessing Baptist Podcast. If you would like to submit a question to the Ask a Reformed Baptist segment, please email us at confessingbaptist@gmail.com or through our Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, or Google Plus page.
For these links and more, please visit us at confessingbaptist.com. Soli Deo Gloria. We'll be right back.